Designed for Living Talk Radio Show on the Amazing Women of Power, the world's leading positive programming network, powered by Raven International, AWOPTalk247.com, where you can listen while you work. You are listening to this weekly Monday broadcast show at 10:30 Pacific Standard Time, aired again at 4:30 Pacific Standard Time, hosted by registered nurse, marriage and family therapist, master life coach, and author Michelle Downey. And I am your co-host, Bob Womack.
Well, I'm very excited because this morning I get to talk to Scott Silverman, whom I met at an Addiction for Professionals meeting the other day. And hi, Scott. Good morning.
Hey, Michelle. How are you? It's nice to hear your voice again.
Yeah. It was a very wonderful meeting, and it was wonderful to actually meet you. There were so many things that you had that were, I thought very inspirational. First of all, you're a coach and a speaker, but evidently there's an award that you received from CNN. I mean, all kinds of exciting things. But the best thing is both of us work in the same field, and I can see your passion for working with families affected by addictions and treatment centers in this field. So with that, I don't have a lot of background information. I'll let you let our audience get some of that, and then, you know, maybe I can ask a few questions along the way, if that's okay.
No, that would be great. You know, and it's very kind of you to mention all the things I've done, but I'm older than you, so it's easy for me. You stay on the planet long enough, and you stay committed to your own passion, there's a lot more you can actually get done. And I've been fortunate enough to do some things in my career that I love to do, and I take advantage of those opportunities and those nuggets to get better at what I do and to help others. And that's really part of what happened with CNN. Is they recognized my work back in the day when I was running a charitable organization, and it was a real honor to be named CNN Hero. It was actually back in 2008.
And, oh, wow.
You know, it was acknowledgement of the work that I did every day on a basis of love, and it was acknowledged that way. So that was a very exciting time, and, you know, continues to be one of the things I'm most proud of.
What was the name of the charity?
It was called Second Chance. The idea was to everyone deserves one, and it was about helping individuals coming out of jail and prison who needed assistance getting jobs and housing. And I learned the way to do that was if you can help someone, because you need it. You know, I was a homeless provider by definition, and you need an address to get a job, and of course, you need a job to keep an address. So what I would do was I found a way to combine the two of those through my nonprofit that I created, and the goal was to help the underserved find ways to get back to, you know, whether it's school or work, and help them reunite with their family. So it was, and I did that for 18 years. It was a very exciting time.
Oh, my goodness. That's a lot of years. That's wonderful. So how did you decide to get into this field, just out of curiosity?
You mean the field that I'm currently in, or?
It doesn't matter. Whatever field.
Okay.
Just how did
whatever
you start
field,
doing
yeah.
charity work? That's beautiful.
Well, you know, it's fascinating. I was involved with, you know, my temple, and one of the things that, you know, our special time of the year, the Jewish New Year, they make an announcement, who would like to come down and feed the homeless? And I thought, well, that's an interesting invitation. So I queried it and found out, and I went down one day and started helping. I helped on a Sunday, and they asked every family to come for one Sunday a year, and brought my wife at the time, and we went down and we fed the homeless. And I stayed for 2 years. So I worked every Sunday, and after a few months, I just started getting kind of frustrated. And I'd see these people, and every Sunday, they'd have to come wait in line with 800 or 900 other people. And this is back in the early 90s, and think, God, all day long to wait for a meal. Started asking questions, why aren't you working? Who would hire me? And so, long story short, I kind of like Peter Pan, I sat out in the parking lot after my 5 hours of feeding and said, I'll help you. I'll show you, and I will help mentor you to go get a job. So I started working on it, and all of a sudden I have 40, 50 people, every Sunday wanting to learn how to do it. It's not hard when you know how, but if you don't know how, it's hard. So I showed them the way to do it, how to make a presentation, how to make eye contact, how to smile. And my joke used to be, it doesn't matter how many teeth you have, even if you only have one, if you smile, everything sounds better. So I grew up in a retail business, so I had a lot of skill around, you know, employment, and part of my job was hiring people. So I just shared the things I'd learned over the years to make it easy. And then basically I went to all the providers in San Diego that I could find and said, look, I want to partner with you. I'll do the workforce piece. You do the mental health. You do the treatment. You do the housing. You know, you do the wraparound. You do the transportation. I want to help them find work. And they're like, why? I said, well, because I think it's important, and they don't have to be dependent on others. And they said, well, wait a minute, Scott, if you help these people get jobs, what will we do? And I said, find another job. So they basically blacklisted me and said, we're not going to work with you. So that night I went home, I shared the story with my wife, and she says, really, what are you going to do about it? I said, I'm going to go start a nonprofit. She goes, you have no idea what you're talking about, do you? I go, no, but I'm excited. So I went to the library the next day and started doing a little homework, because back in those days there was no internet. And this was in 90, 91, and came up with this concept, created it, went after it, learned how to fundraise, how to develop a board, and built a multi-million-dollar organization with $10 million in assets when I left about 6 years ago. And it's still out there thriving, and I'm excited to know that I was able to make a difference and set a path for people to create systemic change.
Oh, my God, there's a lot of work involved in that. I'm really impressed, and I'm not surprised that you ran up against that kind of, I don't know what you call it, but it's that's typical. And what most people would do would give up. They would just give up. But you went ahead, and you forged ahead, and you learned about it. My God. And that's not a small endeavor. Learning how to set up a nonprofit is amazing. Oh, my God.
Yeah. Well, that's the technical, mechanical part. But I'll tell you what was really hard was learning how to fundraise, learning how to raise resources, learning how to – and look, keep in mind, Michelle, the customer I was trying to serve was an ex-con. It was a person who'd been homeless. It was a person that people had become so accustomed to seeing on the streets. They were stepping over them like they would a rock or a stone or a pothole. It's like, really? And I was trying to, you know, and all I wanted to do was empower people because that made me feel good, and it made them feel good, and it really solved a major community issue. So, and then, but to be honest, you know what that prepared me for was working with the prison system. As I moved into my arena of 6 or 7 years of being a nonprofit, I started working with the ex-offenders exclusively from a recruitment perspective. And because, you know, the prison system in California has an 80% recidivism rate, it was easy for me to work with some of these clients coming out because there was no real safety net for them. So what I did was created a portal for opportunity for jobs and housing. And guess what? We created a program around prison reentry that reduced recidivism by 70% simply by giving someone the basic resources, food, transportation, housing, and the basic skills, and then support them for a long period of time. Because our program was 4 weeks with a 2-year follow-up, which ties into what I'm doing now at Confidential Recovery in an outpatient program where 6 weeks, licensed facility, with a 2-year follow-up. So the model, not only do I know experientially works, but science says, and the evidence confirms, if you can keep someone engaged for a year, you can reduce recidivism. I'm talking around substance abuse and addiction treatment.
Absolutely. Go ahead.
For 2 years, you can reduce it in half again. When I say keep them engaged, they can do whatever they need to do, whether it's 12-step, non-12-step, but some sort of engagement, just like we do with diabetes. You get your insulin, you check your blood sugar levels every day, you adjust accordingly, and if you follow the formula, you can live a normal, happy life. And guess what? I believe for people who have an addiction or a substance abuse problem, whether it's prescription-based or street purchase, that there's hope and there's a way to make changes, and it's really not as complicated as the system wants to make it. There's a lot of work, big commitment, lots of systemic change, a lot of transformation, nothing that you used to do can be the way it was. You have to make a lot of change in your life, but once you make them, maintaining them, once you have the skill sets, is not hard. So I got into this business of substance abuse treatment because I believe the model that I had worked before could work again. And I've been in recovery myself personally for a little over 31 years, so I know by staying involved, you can make changes and they will stick.
Yeah. Oh, my God. That's absolutely correct and so inspirational. That's so neat because that's a – how did you have the support? I mean, did you – I mean, obviously your temple community supported, you know, your first entry into service-oriented work. But as you went along this road, how did you get support to create what you've created and do what you've done?
You know, it's interesting because some of my, and I grew up in San Diego, so some of my closest family, friends, you know, when you start a new business or you try, you sell a new product or, you know, I used to be a Fuller Brush salesperson or Mary Kay, you know, you call your immediate family, then you call your secondary family, then you call
right.
the ancillary family, then you call the outlaws, then you call the cousins, and then you ask them to call their friends. And that's kind of how I built the infrastructure. But, you know, it's interesting. My community didn't really support what I was doing initially. I mean, even though they're very philanthropic and very altruistic, it was a very difficult battle because the thinking was, why do we want to help those people?
Yeah.
And when I presented my definition of those people and broke it down for people, I said, this is your community. This is our community. This is their community. It's not those people. This is somebody's mother's brother, son, daughter, uncle, aunt, sister, cousin, grandpa, grandma. And I said, when you think about it, I'd rather help manage a situation than try to deny it and hope it'll go away because it rarely does go away on its own. You know, it's just like a parent who has a child who has a behavior problem. It doesn't fix itself.
No.
You know, if you have a rose bush that isn't growing correctly, sometimes you have to change the soil. Sometimes you have to treat it differently. Sometimes, as my wife says, you've got to go out and just talk to it, which I'm trying to talk to her about stop talking to roses. But she loves her roses and her garden. And she does that as she believes, you know what? And when you believe something strong enough and you do it on a regular basis, just like, you know, peace and happiness and gut health and nutrition and fitness and serenity and love, when you practice a little bit each day, you can maintain the investment you make in whatever it is you wish to do. And I call it investment because I like the term emotional ROI, emotional return on investment, meaning if it feels right put feeling into it, you're going to get something back out of it. You know, one of the things I've learned in my own personal recovery is I can't keep it if I don't give it away.
Yeah. Oh,
so.
Amazing. It's really exciting to meet somebody who is that convicted and has been able to establish that kind of success because that is a very difficult marginal section of society. And of course, I worked on it from the other end. I was employed by, you know, as a nurse for a crisis center. So that was my introduction to that world. But I never had the empowerment that you've had. It's wonderful to see. What do you do for inspiration? And why did you do the treatment center now? Why now?
Well, you know, I watched from, you know, my own experience, you know, the prior agency, we had 175 beds on a 9 scattered property. We did not provide treatment. We just created an alcohol and drug-free environment, which I believe most people really want to live in. You know, back in my old day when I was an unlicensed pharmacist, all my customers were anywhere I could find them. So I understand the paradigm shift because at one point I was a distributor of methamphetamine in a big way back in the day, and I was a heavy drinker and I had my own issues. And when I finally got help, I learned some things. And over time, I've learned that unfortunately, when you look at our industry of treatment, and I call it our industry now because I've been in it a couple years now, almost 2 years. You go through a traditional 28-day program and you do nothing afterwards, there's a 95% chance you'll relapse. 95% chance, Michelle. So what I wanted to do, for lack of better framing, is I wanted to build something that would be helpful. And we're an outpatient program. We deal mostly with professionals. We're licensed, so we take some insurance. And we wanted to try to focus on, you know, doctors and lawyers and business people and people who won't go into a traditional inpatient program because either they think their schedule won't permit it, or they don't think they really need a full immersion. And we start with them in the outpatient component. We have a great team of clinical experts, psychologists, psychiatrists, and medical folks who are addiction specialists or passionate about treating people with addictions and their families. And what we try to do is provide an environment. And then we know that if someone's not a good fit, I like the saying, if I can't help you, I will find a way to help you. Because we know one size does not fit all. And 4 out of 5 of the phone calls I get, we can't even help because people do need a higher level of care. And I don't think that really exists in our field of treatment. To answer your question, how do you get inspired? I just spent 3 days at the West Coast Addiction Conference in La Quinta, California, with 1,100 people who are in this business. And I got to tell you, I am so charged up listening to people talk about what works, what we need to do differently, ethics in this industry, accountability, measurables, evidence-based programmatic pieces. And what we do that's kind of unique at Confidential Recovery is our program is 6 weeks with a 2-year follow-up. And nobody in the industry really does that because insurance
doesn't
pay for it. And when you fly across the country to treatment, you can't hang out for 2 years. But and the reason I know the model worked because I had it before and it was studied. Mm-hmm. And you and I both know, Michelle, you don't need to be smart to realize that if you want to maintain a certain level of weight, body weight, mm-hmm. you cannot increase your calories and decrease your exercise. So that's common knowledge. But when it comes to removing mood-altering substances, a lot of people think just by having the 28-day stay, they get on that pink cloud, they feel good, but when the next situation arises, good, bad, or sad, the body doesn't process those feelings organically because you've been anesthetizing yourself for so long. You need help with professional stewardship and guidance, and I love the social model. Science says it's one of the best indicators of success, but it's long-term commitment. So that's why I created, with my partner, Dwayne, Confidential Recovery. We wanted to create a portal for people who really believe that what's going on in their life, they need to change. And, every provider I've ever met says, look, we provide substance abuse treatment, we have clinicians. They say the same thing, and I get it. But our 2-year follow-up, and by the way, in order to gather that up, it's pretty rare insurance will cover it. Most of the people we treat pay cash for it, and we liken it, to a gym membership or maintaining your car, or as my daughter would say, getting my Brazilian blowout every 6 weeks so my hair stays straight. Whatever you want to call it, we take better care of our cars than we do our bodies. And what's fascinating to me is we talk more about kids with lice in their hair at school than we do about getting access to substance abuse treatment. And, Michelle, the other day about this prescription opiate epidemic in our country. It's overwhelming right now. You can't watch the news now and not see 4 or 5 major news stories. And they're not going to go away because not with 264 million prescriptions written last year for opiates.
That's right.
You and I both know it is going to be a lot worse before it gets better, unfortunately. So I hope that answers your question about what charges me up. Being with other like-minded people who are passionate about helping others, who really get it. And there are a lot of people that don't. 95% failure rate in an industry. What other industry could last through a 95% failure rate?
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. Unfortunately, we're about out of time. If you want to, if any of our listeners would like to talk to you or talk to the Confidential Treatment team, or is there a way we could get hold of you?
I'm going to give you 2 different numbers. I'm going to give you Confidential's number. It's 619-452-1200. That's 619-452-1200. And they can reach us online, if you will, on the web at confidentialrecovery.com. It's confidentialrecovery.com. That's how I say it in my head when I'm typing it out. Or they can go. And I'm also going to give you, I'm going to give you my cell number. The reason I want to do that is I really dare people, just like my book says, Tell Me No, I Dare You. That's my book. And they can find that on my website. But they can always Google me, Scott H. Silverman, anywhere you can find me. But I want to give you my cell number because I want people to call. I don't care where you are in the world, when you hear this, call me, text me, and we'll talk about it. And if I can't help you, I'll help point you in a direction I think will. So my cell number is 619-993-2738. at 619-993-2738. So those are all the different ways anyone can reach me anytime, Michelle, and I'll do everything I can to respond in a very timely manner. Because at the end of the day, when somebody calls me back and says, I got a job, I got sober, I got my family back, I'm living and breathing again, I'm out of jail. And the jail sometimes can be, you know, something they have in their own head because of the lifestyle that's chosen them or they've chosen. So I want to be of service, so give me a call.
Thank you so much. It's been such an honor and a pleasure to have you on my show. And I will, I think everybody got all that information because you repeated it twice. That was just the other thing I usually have to ask people. You already knew. So thank you so much, and I hope you have a good day. I know that you're very busy, so thank you for your time.
Thank you very much for the opportunity. I look forward to spending more time with you and doing great things together.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Until then, let life be well and good.